Hello, I'm Rebecca, the founder of Trio, and welcome to Pep Talks with Trio. Trio is the leading solution for workplaces to support their people during every life transition, from starting a family to retiring, and every life event in between. On Pep Talks with Trio, we chat to our expert partners for advice on how to best navigate these common, complex, and often messy life stages that happen during our working career. Keep listening as we connect the dots between life and work with the simple aim of education and empowerment. After all, life happens at work. Good morning. Today on Pep Talks with Trio, we're speaking with Mitch King. Now, Mitch is the head of talent at Mutinex and has a background in recruitment within tech and creative. And personally, I find him one of the funniest people on LinkedIn, and I highly recommend that you give Mitch a follow. So today we're going to be discussing job hunting in this economically challenging market, post-redundancy, and specific to the tech world. Mitch, welcome. Thank you for being
here. Thank you. No worries. Thanks for having me.
Could you please tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do?
So I'm in talent acquisition, which for anyone who isn't familiar with that space, it's internal recruitment. There are some differences between what you might know as a recruitment agent, recruitment consultants that does it for multiple companies. I do it for one company. So I'm looking at everything from what do we say in our job ads, what processes do we run, finding the people and headhunting them. So anything from that, how we and who we hire.
Great. So, I mean, there's a lot of information and sort of news in the media around the market and the economy. And, you know, we do all probably know people that have been made redundant. So I think it's very pertinent that we're having this discussion today. In technology, which is obviously where you are now, where we are and where your background sits, is there still a solid job flow? What are you actually seeing in the tech space?
Yeah, I think, and maybe it's, you know, certain types of media need the or want the headlines that push bigger stories. So, you know, there's a recession in tech, or it's an absolute disaster. There's probably some, what's the word? There's pockets within that story. So some are true, some are less true, some are the opposite. So with tech as a blanket sector, that's quite hard to cover everyone in one go. Yeah. Startups, you know, talking small companies, some of, you know, 10 people, some might still call themselves startup and had investments and be 100 people. And then you've got big tech. You've got, you know, the Googles and the Canvas of the world. It's really hard to class them all in the same, you know, financial category. And then you've got different job sectors within that. You've got technical engineering roles, you've got marketing, you've got design. So each of these has its own nuances to what the market is doing, what the supply and demand is. And really, probably the thing that gets missed the most in context is the hiring boom that tech went through from around the end of 2020 through 2021. Those numbers were so high and so unsustainable that when they've come down, they've come back down to about the middle.
Yeah.
But people's expectations is that they'll have that many jobs still. Mm-hmm. You know, that's for every engineer, there's going to be 20 jobs. Was really now it's maybe for every engineer, there's like 5 jobs, but there's still this supply and demand, is there?
Yeah, so there's still more jobs from the candidates available in the market.
Depending on what they are. In software engineering, technical like data roles, cybersecurity, yes, you've probably got multiple jobs for each candidate. For others, there might not. There might be one-to-one. There might be the opposite. There might be one job for every 10. So it's what I mean by there's not a blanket, you know, rule for this. And then you could look at locations. You know, we went through a period of remote hiring that's drawn back a fair bit so that companies want people in certain locations. So Sydney's going to be different to Melbourne. The other parts of Australia are going to be very different as well. So there's a lot of filters you need to apply to get to the true data.
Yeah. Okay. And in terms of the redundancy piece, obviously we've spoken about you having held the hand of people through this process, which one can't be a particularly enjoyable experience for yourself or for, you know, the employee being made redundant. What would your advice be to anyone that is being made redundant? Really more from that, let's look at it first from that more personal sort of acceptance internal process, and then we'll look at it from a returning to the market perspective.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, if you try to find a positive, if you've been laid off, made redundant, hopefully that came with some form of payment, and that payment might just give you some time to not work, whether it's a week, a month, whatever it might be. People that I know, friends, former colleagues who've been laid off, and listening to their questions, their experiences again, there's some really sort of common things that happen with people. Loss of confidence is probably the major one. Seems to be really common for people to really attach their identities to their jobs and their roles, and then having that sort of taken away from them in a, you know, one fell swoop can be hard to adapt to, and they can sort of spiral. So I think if anyone has the chance, now I wasn't made redundant when I left my last job, I had a break, and I just really, really needed it. I just really needed to just not be in that, you know, 40, 50, 60 hour a week sort of grinds and mindset. And you know, there's lots of different versions of this in the market, but there's the hustle and grinders out there who believe that you're just always working and you're always making dollars, and that's the most important thing. And there's others who believe that, you know, work has its place in the overall scheme of life. So if you can have that break and just really focus on things you enjoy, things that you've been putting off for a long time, whether it's work-related courses, whether it's learning how to, I don't know, make clay, fixing your garden up, like all those sorts of things can be, I think, really helpful. And then get yourself into the job hunting mindset. I think a lot of people maybe don't appreciate the work that can go into looking for a job. Some people have had careers where they've just always been in demand. You know, they top university, got a job in a great company, a big name company. And it's with that, it comes a lot of momentum that you're just always being approached. Yeah. And they might not understand that that's not everyone's experience when it comes to the job hunting. And others have to, you know, they have to go out there, they have to find, they have to apply, they have to network, they have to do all of the things. And it's, as well as the hours, it's a mental drain going through the process.
So if we look at that re-entering the job market, you know, you've touched on a few things, and mentoring, coaching came up for me, upskilling, reskilling, looking at, you know, what is the, albeit there's the different verticals, you know, if within a company, whether you're in HR or marketing, sales, tech, and then obviously you've got the levels. So it's a really complex, I completely appreciate this is not a simple answer. And I guess depending on what vertical you are and what level you are within a company, obviously the higher up you are, theoretically you would have had potentially a bigger payout, but then obviously the higher up the pyramid you are, the fewer jobs there are. So potentially your ability to get back into the market quickly is going to be harder than somebody where there may be more volume of jobs in the market, but I'll be more candidates. So
yeah.
You know, what would your advice be around, you know, is finding a coach or a mentor to really regain that confidence? Is doing some internal work and understanding, do I need some reskilling or upskilling to open up more doors? When we are, you know, sort of looking at, you know, almost using this as an opportunity to reevaluate, because we can often so be on that hamster wheel, reevaluate, where are we? What do I actually want to do? You know, what is there other things that I can do to help myself transition back?
Yeah, I think, as you say, it's very dependent. Like if you have coach, myself looked at a confidence coach, I'm sure they exist, but that if you can afford it, it definitely won't be a bad idea. Let's say I'll answer this in the, if someone's in the category of, you know, money's not
the biggest
accessible
driver
for them. Yeah, they don't really have a ton of it to just go out and pay for all these services and coaching and tools. Because, you know, there's going to be people who were made redundant, but they didn't meet the criteria to get payouts. So they're really, you know, they're forced out and they have to scramble quite quickly. So I think some of the things that I would recommend is, firstly, if you can find a peer support group. So if you were made redundant as amongst others in the same company, don't isolate yourself from them. Like, seek them out, join up, because what you find and what works in companies that have that sort of culture or that alumni is you're expanding on your reach because of that people. Let's say there's 20 people and you're an engineer, but in that group, there's a designer, there's a marketer. Sometimes a marketer is going to speak to someone who's like, do you know any engineers? And they go, yeah, actually I do. It's like, here they are. And so that sort of flow on effect of my network, like I spoke to a company, I've got a friend there, they don't have anything for me, but they have all these roles potentially for you. Yeah. That I'm seeing that firsthand at the moment in one of the groups I'm in, that it really proactively, like, yeah, here's a job, someone approached me, I'm too senior, I'm too junior, not my skill set. That can really help, as well as just the more of the mental support that you get through this process of people being like, being able to share with each other. And I don't know, maybe there's not a, these safe spaces aren't everywhere, but share the, I've just been rejected, I haven't heard back, is anyone else finding this a really just shit process to go through, which, you know, is what I'm sort of always like thinking of on my side when we're hiring people who've been through this. So I think that can help. And then when it comes to your sort of actively searching, I think probably the most common mistake people make is being totally dependent on applying for jobs. So they're passive. They sit, wait, check the job boards, apply, and that's all they do.
Yeah.
So the things that even I did when I was job hunting was obviously I'd still apply for the jobs, but I'm researching companies, I'm approaching people, and I'm saying, I would want to work for you if you have any roles for this reason.
Yeah.
I ended up putting like a pitch deck together for a couple of companies, but luckily enough, got my role, so I didn't get to send it out a lot. But just instead of a CV, it's like, hey, this is what I do. This is how I can do it. And I wasn't restricting myself to only full-time roles, because there could be those, if short-term gig, great. There's some money coming in. There's a network that you're building. There's some more experience. But I think people maybe miss or underestimate how often a short-term gig or a contract turns into something longer-term and full-time. I think I'm super aware of it because of what I've done in my career in running contract desks and having all these conversations every week of like, hey, we want to hire a contractor. Like that was just, that was a regular occurrence. So I know that it happens, but I speak to people and they're just like, oh, I never thought of freelancing or contracting. Like it never occurred to them. And you just never know. Like the more messages you send out to people, the more you'll sort of find like, oh, actually, we were going to be looking for this person. Like, let's have a chat. Or we're not, but my friend just asked if I knew anyone. Let me introduce you to them. So that proactiveness, and this might not be a helpful statement to people who are in the situation right now, but if you put time and effort into your network proactively, then you're a step ahead when you're in these situations. So what I mean by time and effort network is, like, we've all got colleagues, former colleagues, probably one of the most underutilized resources in a network is, when's the last time you checked in with them? When's the last time you said, hey, how are you going? What's up with you? How are the kids? Do you want to have a coffee? It's part of what I reason that I post regularly on LinkedIn or interact with people on there is just be like, you know, I'm not doing it for any purpose, but right then and there. But when I am looking for a job or do have a request, it's not like that stranger out of the blue asking me for a job. It's just, yeah, this is somebody I know, and keeping top of mind. If somebody says to them, hey, do you know a talent person, a recruiter, that hopefully you're one of the two or three that they might send over.
Yeah.
So I think that value in the network is not utilized enough.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of people, and it's hard, isn't it? If you've been made redundant and when, you know, like you say, you've lost your confidence, we don't often want to be out on LinkedIn saying, hey, I need a job. I've lost my job. I need a job. But actually, there has been times where I've seen people say, you know, do you know anyone in your network? This is what I'm looking for. And the number of people that share the posts, that tag people, the power of the network is actually incredible. So for sure, you know, if you haven't actually maintained, you know, regular contact with your network, okay, you know, yes, you can't sort of retrace your steps and do that now, but you can still, I think people generally as humans, we genuinely want to help where we can. And even just reaching out to those people and saying, you know, because, you know, yes, you can put your, you know, the notice on your profile saying, you know, I'm looking for work or available for work. But often people, our network are so busy that unless we actually ask, do you know anyone, only then do people, it sort of drops in them and go, well, actually, you know, I do know this person. Or, you know, you might then see a job and flick it over to that person because they've actually asked you, you know, can you help me? I do think there is a huge power in the network. And in terms of that sort of passive approach, that's particularly relevant, isn't it, when people are either waiting for jobs to come up on, say, LinkedIn or Seek, or they just approach recruiters and wait for the recruiter to bring them roles. And I think both of those absolutely have a place in the market. So if we look at that sort of recruitment space, do you advocate for trying to align yourself with, you know, one or two recruiters and really tailor your time there? Or do you go to every recruiter that is in the tech space or the HR space or the sales space and try and maximize your opportunities that way?
Definitely not the latter. Basically, what most recruiters' mindset will be, if you're someone that's working with every recruiter in the market, is that you're a false commodity and that no one can place you because everyone's represented you already. It's a, you know, an assumption. So similar to a network thing, and I know it can be hard to know if a recruiter is good or not, but that's where sometimes it's worth taking that call, having a meeting, having a coffee, or really asking your network for referrals. Who's the best recruiter you've worked with in our space? One to two max is generally my advice. But I think particularly when you've got the niche ones, you know, like if you're who can I give a shout out to? If you're in, say, cybersecurity and you talk to Ricky, who I've now forgotten his last name. If you're in creative and you speak to, you know, creative natives, like that, and sort of being in touch with them and on their radar, you know, I think helps. And again, it's more helpful to be known to them 6 months prior than when you're antsy for the role. And I was just thinking about this earlier randomly as well, that I have, there's sort of like a tiered scale. You can have a really specialist recruiter. So let's say it's cybersecurity. You could then have specialist industry, so tech, and then generalists who'll just work on anything that they're given. Like I would never touch a generalist. I'd never give a role to a generalist. It's like the middle aisle of Aldi. Just like it could be absolutely anything. Yeah. Just like it could be absolutely anything. Yeah. In there. And that becomes really like a different sort of service. Like basic requirements. Here's a profile that fits. But really getting into details and knowing, you know, the nuances between, you know, like I've done a lot of design roles and I've had a lot of clients come and say, like, hey, we had this recruiter, but this is what they sent us. And I look at those designers and go, holy shit, like, these are some of the most inappropriate profiles you've been sent, and this is a recruiter sending them to you. Like, here's five, and this is why they're aligned. So, yeah, finding specialists and good ones, ideally referrals from people in your own network that do that, that's where I'd start. But yeah, definitely don't try to send your details to everyone. You'll get a reputation, really. The scenario is, I'm a recruiter, I put your details forward, I discuss the role with you, I put your details forward. Client comes back, oh, we've already had this person sent to us three times. And you go back and you ask them why, like, oh, I forgot, like, you know, I can't keep track. I thought it would increase my chances if more people send my details. I heard that one a lot, and if anyone has thought that, it just causes conflict, because now that client has to mitigate the fight between recruiters on who gets a fee.
That's right. Yeah. My background's recruitment, and I remember that's, you know, that is an absolute nightmare. And I think just to your point there, in terms of finding somebody and aligning yourself with one or two, backing my previous life as a recruiter, you know, we were targeted on keeping in contact with the candidates just to understand what's going on in the market, but also to keep understand where your candidate is, because if a perfect job comes in, then you have this almost a passive candidate market that no one else is across, to bring those amazing roles to the candidate because you know what that candidate's looking for. So there's a really reciprocal relationship between candidate and recruiter if you can find someone that you really gel with and understand. And obviously, from a recruiter's point of view, I always met my candidates, because you really, and I think a lot of candidates in this market can often, and potentially now, because we're, you know, we are also remote, but actually meeting someone and really understanding and getting under the skin of that person really helps you as a recruiter match them much better with the organization that's recruiting. So it's better for the organization, it's better for the candidate. They get opportunities of jobs which aren't even on, you know, on the market yet. So I think for candidates or employees, investing in their recruitment network ahead of time is really, really valuable.
Yeah, and it probably, you know, for the ideal, I guess, recruitment relationship, it needs to be, as you said, mutual. It needs to be a mutual outcome for, you know, the candidates, for the recruiter, and for the company. I think as soon as there's a assertion of hierarchy that client is top, recruiter is second, candidate's third, it just leads to all sorts of, I don't know how much I'm supposed to swear or can swear on this, but all sorts of nonsense. So I think in the recruiter's defense, it's an underappreciated part of the role is how much time they spend, how much time good recruiters spend with candidates, and how that is built into the fees that they charge. It's, you know, companies who don't like using recruiters, their assumption is, well, I've got to pay a lot of money, and all they did was send me five people. It's like that all those five people took was 2 years to build a network, constant conversations, 8,000 coffees, you know, LinkedIn licenses, all these sorts of stuff. You know, it is that understanding of what a recruiter's doing, and why also, like, I wouldn't, in my position, if I was using a recruiter, I'll only ever use one at a time, and I'll only ever use them in a very sort of transparent, you know, process. If I can't use them, it's just like, hey, no, let's not, I'm not going to waste your time. But I know that's not always commonplace, because, like, I've been a candidate, I've been an agency recruiter, I've been internal talent, so I know the frustrations from all three sides, maybe four sides if you include the hiring manager or the CEO or the boss or whatever. Like, they've got their own perspectives as well. So aligning all of those people up for one outcome and everyone happy is definitely possible, and it just reduces the friction and the pain if you do that, as opposed to, again, like, that assertion of hierarchy or dominance.
Yeah, I always think recruitment actually is one of the hardest jobs in the world because you're dealing with people. You know, they're not products. You know, you're not just selling hardware. You know, everyone has, you know, and there's so many people involved in the process to actually get to a, you know, a solid outcome, and people change their minds all the time. And if we look at that in terms of, you know, if you've been made redundant and you're desperate to get back into the market, you know, I always used to set tell my candidates, you know, you are also interviewing that company. You know, show up, you know, be yourself, you know, don't pretend to be what you think they need, because you really do want to be hired for you. But when you're in this situation where maybe you are desperate to get a job and, you know, you're worried, how important do you think that still is for candidates to really try and find the role that is right for them from a permanent perspective? I do think with, you know, sort of contracting roles, sometimes with clients, it is a bit more of a plaster. You know, we just need somebody for short term. But to your point, the number of roles that start off as contracting and then become permanent, I think that's also a great way for candidates who maybe are a bit of a round peg in a square hole to be able to get into a company which perhaps if it was a permanent role and there would be potentially more candidates suitable for that position, you know, being able to leverage that contracting space because you are immediately available, because you're immediately available, your volume of competition is less. You know, people typically won't leave a permanent role to jump into a contracting gig. But if you're immediately available, then that opens up a whole different world for you. And because the volume of candidates isn't always as high, you can sometimes, you know, really get a bit of a round peg in a square hole, and therefore, you know, I guess spread your experience or get into an industry that you potentially haven't got the experience in. And if it was in a permanent gig, you wouldn't necessarily get a looking, but it's a great way to expand, you know, your career and your experience.
Yeah, like again, because of the I spent about 7 years, I think, running a contract sort of recruitment sort of side of things, and I could tell you 100 stories of people that dipped their toe into freelance and then never left.
Yeah.
They It was accidental, and it was something that like, oh, I'm just going to do this while, and then I was speaking to someone about this recently where you won't even know until you actually announce it. And then all of a sudden people come to Woolworths going, oh, if you're available for freelance, like we're going to need someone. Could you do this job? And I think this is a growing trend amongst the, I can never remember the generations, amongst the youths of having multiple incomes and revenues rather than just a full-time role. And they've got all these different things on the fly. I would say sometimes it's hard to actually get contract work in an area that you're not an expert in. Usually, the more of an expert you are, so for designers, for example, what we had to do from that contract desk was make sure we were putting specialists in where they were required. So it used to be FMCG packaging design used to be the hardest one to fill, but if you had good people, you were in a good business. So you couldn't put a graphic or digital designer into an FMCG packaging gig. There's just too much nuance to it. There's too many things you need to have done before and learned from the mistakes. So it's not always that you could branch out, but it might depend. It might depend on who that network is. That was also because I was a recruiter. Companies are coming to me because they couldn't find either someone available soon enough or with that niche skill set. So they were paying for my time, my network to find that skill set. But it's definitely there's new platforms emerging. Again, another shout out for anyone in marketing. If they look at a company called, what's it, Mash Brands, this is Mash. There's a few different ones I have out there. They are basically building like a global network of on-demand marketers and marketing teams. I've spoken to a few marketers about this and like, oh, I didn't know that existed. And then they go into it. And so Mash is getting these requests from brands all over the world. And sometimes it's might be a brand in, say, Europe who doesn't know anything about Australia and they need Australian local experts for 3 months.
Yeah, great. What a great
You know?
business.
Yeah. And so they do stuff like that and then think, what's that going to look like on your CV? okay, now I've got this European brand and I've done that in Australia. What happens next? You find an Australian company that needs to push into Europe, and all of a sudden you've learned some things and it snowballs, you know. So being like keeping that really open mind, like I've had a lot of experience with people that they know they need a full-time role, that's what they have to get, and they're so laser focused on it that they reject any freelance and contract work. 3 months later, they're still looking for a full-time job when they could have had 3 months of freelance work while looking for a full-time job. There's nothing that stops you from still looking for a full-time job when you take on this short-term contract work, but there's money coming in, there's skill sets, there's new names to put on CVs and LinkedIn profiles. It's a win-win, but there's maybe some assumptions people need to drop when they think about that path.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a flick of the switch that a permanent is the only security in the job market, you know, in terms of if I have a permanent job, it offers me more security than if I go into this contracting world. And that's not always the case, is it?
Well, I think these layoffs have probably taught a lot of people about what security is. You know, I used to not fight with people, but when they say that they want to work in a big company because it was more secure, and I went to, there was a couple of big four consultancies that made a few hundred people redundant during COVID. It's like, what makes you think that's more secure now? You know, the and this is, I think, some of the things that are driving the youth to look at this and go, why have you old people been doing this for so long? Like, why are you putting up with this crap, working for companies for 10 years and then kicked out the door and no one even says thank you? You know, they're pushing back on it. But yes, I think that probably that biggest assumption was if they go into freelance and contract work, that that now puts them in that category exclusively. There's just zero reason that that's the, or evidence that that's really the case that I've seen, because you don't even have to put it on your CV if you don't want to. You're applying for a job and I'm doing some freelance and contract work at the same time. So, I mean, to me, that's a positive. It's not a negative in any way if someone's sought out work, sought out an income while they're looking for the right full-time home. And for the people that I spoke about that went into freelancing and never left because they liked it and they wanted to stay, it's not a do this or do that. It's try this while you're looking for that sort of situation.
And are the consulting or contracting gigs, do they still command a sort of a higher salary because they're shorter term compared to a permanent? So actually there is an offset for from a financial benefit as well. You get a higher daily rate or, you know, whatever the rate is versus a permanent gig, but that's because it offsets the fact that you may have periods in between gigs where there may be some
Yeah,
downtime.
definitely.
Suits a lot of
Yeah,
people
you
as
should.
well.
Yeah, I think I was speaking to someone about this recently who they hadn't freelanced before and they were trying to work out what a freelance rate was. There's a couple of old school formulas in recruitment where you take your salary, divide it by 220, because that's the number of, I think, working days in Australia in a year, taking out annual leave, taking out
Okay.
public holidays and that sort of stuff. You take that and then you can add a percentage to that. So I think the low end was about 20, 25% to cover for all of those things. But then there's also the market rates will determine that. You know, you'll see a senior software engineer might get, say, $800 to $1,000 a day as a contractor. And then it will depend on how long is it for, what size of company. You know, sometimes you'll see people go into these like government type contracts, and it's just because they pay quite well, you know. So yes, you should be making more per day, per hour in those sorts of gigs. And depending on how senior you are, you know, there's advisory consultancy type ones where it's just a few hours here and there. People just need your advice and expertise. But yeah, it's, I know, like even from my position, a reason that I couldn't go and start freelancing right now is my mortgage. I've got to pay the mortgage. The bank doesn't like sole traders, you know. So that can be something, but again, it doesn't have to be forever. To set up an ABN takes 20 minutes, costs $30, something like that. It's not a you know, anytime I have invoice, I do it in Canva. It's not complex, you know. It's, yeah, you can figure it out. So
Or if it's
it's
through a
just,
recruiter, they deal with all of that anyway, you know.
yeah, most recruiters will run the payroll for you. That was that. Well, we'll say most. I haven't looked at it recently. I know that it was a big reason people liked freelancing for us back then is because we paid them weekly. There are other freelancers, other recruiters, usually smaller ones, who pay the invoice when it's paid by the client. And that can cause a lot of tension, usually when the client delays the payment. But it ends, the recruiter rates will vary. They're usually a little bit less than what you will get directly. But again, it's a trade-off on their network and being able to be found. But there's lots of new platforms like Mash emerging. Expert 360, Worklink is another one that has that sort of on-demand short term. So you apply to be part of the Worklink community. These jobs come in, you basically put your hand up or sort of tender for that job. And then it becomes like, hang on, I've got three of these lined up. I'm making what I would make in, you know, 6 months in the next three. Your mindset can change once you've got the confidence, once you've got a bit of momentum, and you might find that you don't want to be a full-time employee anymore.
Mitch, this has been such valuable insight. So what I'm hearing is really build on your network. You know, first of all, have that peer support to help yourself. So find that peer support network. Build upon all of your networks. Choose one or two recruiters to align yourself to, and be really, really flexible in your approach to what opportunities can come your way. But don't just sit back and wait. Be really proactive in going out there and working your network, looking at the technology available in terms of other job opportunities, and be open to the type of work that you take on, because actually that can open up the doors to so much else as.
The other things that I recommend people is time boxing the what they spend on what activities. Particularly job boards. I've seen a lot of people, they just get into this like mindset of job boards all day. Job boards, like, with your coffee, 1 hour, and then stop. They'll be there tomorrow. And just a lot of these, a lot of the misinformation out there, people ask me questions sometimes. I'm just like, where the hell did you get this idea from? Like, it's bad to apply to a job too early. It's bad if you don't apply to a job in 3 days. It's like, listen, I don't know what you think I see on the other side, but I'm not sitting there waiting for an application to come in and looking at the time. Like, when I come back to that and I do them together, you've all applied at the same time as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, spending, like, if I was, when I was looking for a job, it'd be like, look at job boards, and I might spend an hour like researching, like, what startups are emerging? Who's got funding? What's this CEO saying? Do I like that person? I put them on a list. I send them a message. Depending on that, what the rest of my day, when I was doing a podcast, then I might record a podcast. And then I just spend the rest of the day doing me stuff. There's MBA, there's children, there's lawns, you know, all that sort of thing. So I was trying to make sure that I didn't drive myself into dark places because I'm spending 10, 12 hours a day trying to find every niche job board and job listing and waiting for the second. It becomes quite like an addiction to see a new job listed. So, yeah, having some structure to it, mixing it up in X amount of time job boards, X amount of time proactive stuff, X amount of time my network. Who I used to work with, who do I like, when's the last time I spoke to them? Coffee, beer. Like, having a coffee with someone is probably a better hour spent than a job board.
The job board hole would be, and then waiting for the responses and then getting angsty and angry because they don't come, which is just mindset. It's just never going to help. It's not. Sometimes I do appreciate the experiences aren't great, but flip over to what you can control and what you can do proactively, And I do love that concept of, looking after your own self-care and doing something for you or with the family to really create that balance. Because let's face it, once you're back into a role, you're working, you're 40, 50, 60, whatever that job requires, to, get in, get up to speed and, retain that position. So
yeah.
Magic. Thank you so much. Great advice. Thank you, Mitch.
No problem. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about how Trio can support your people, visit trio.com.